I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Veterans Affairs to order. Welcome, everybody. We have a huge agenda. There are a couple of bills that we have to carry over already to next Tuesday, the last day. But with that, I want to just quickly open the work session on Senate Bill 796. We cannot work it today because we don't have the fiscal, but we do have someone who wants to just say something about it. So if she would come and just give a couple of minutes on it, then we can get that one off the agenda. The other one that we are carrying over because we don't have a fiscal is Senate Bill 911. So if you're here for Senate Bill 911, you don't need to be here. Those are the only two at this point that I know that we can't address today. All right, so with that, do you want to just say, give a statement on 796?
Okay, I'll just give a few minutes. My name is Patricia Sweeney, and I have an educational service called Spiral of Life in Home Wakes and Funerals. I am basically an educator, and I teach people how to conduct a funeral at home, so to care for their own dead in their own home and in their own way. So, number one, I'm an educator. That's what I am. I understand that in Bill 796, they want to make it illegal to educate people without a license. So that's one of my concerns that I'm speaking here about. That would mean, if you look at my workshops that I teach, that to even teach a class about how to make a coffin would be illegal in Southeast Portland unless I had a license. To teach a class on the history of funerals in America would be illegal if I didn't have a license. To teach a class on the mythologies of death and culture and diversity would be illegal if I didn't have a license. So I'm not so sure that that's a appropriate thing, and I think that besides being an educator, I'm also a videographer and a writer, and I'm going to be documenting the story as it unfolds over the next 5 or 10 years, and I think that the media would pick up on that pretty quickly too. So I just want to make sure that the committee's aware that not being able to speak about death without a license would make a pretty big front page news story. So I just think that it's a little bit over the top, and I think it needs to be amended to make it more accessible for people to speak about death.
What I'd like to, just to let you know, the process, we're right down to the wire. I would love to have you talk with Senator Walker. This is Senator Walker's bill. Tell her about your concerns, because it's not a done deal. If we do pass this out, we can't do it today, but if we do pass it out next Tuesday, it would go over to the House. And if you work with Senator Walker, she is really very easy to work with in most instances.
Great. And then one more final thing I'd like to say. From the governor's webpage, right on his own webpage, when you compare birth midwifery to death midwifery, the governor's webpage, midwifery license in Oregon is voluntary in Oregon. A birth midwifery license.
Speak into the microphone.
A birth midwifery license is voluntary in Oregon, and they actually have hands-on. They actually deliver that baby, and there's actually the possibility of death happening in that situation. So if that's voluntary, then why would a person speaking about funerals and death have to have a license? So there's a lot of contradiction there that I think needs to be addressed.
I really appreciate you for coming. And did you sign up? We need to make sure we have your name. We want to make sure, state your name for the record again.
My name is Patricia Sweeney.
And you have her. Okay. Thank you so very much. And with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 796. And with that, I'd like to open the
2762.
House Bill 2762.
Oh, the bill. Jeez.
And
which
with
one?
The...
Huh? Which one?
He couldn't have them. He didn't have a quorum. Those are two of them.
This is a bill. Would you want to describe what this
is?
Yes,
Madam Chair, House Bill 2762A designates May 8th of each year as Military Family Appreciation Day. This House bill was passed by the Veterans Affairs Committee on the House side last week. Thank you for agreeing to hear this today. We had to schedule this quickly because we don't want to miss the May 8th day. There will be a number of celebrations, and it's Military Family Appreciation Day. We do have, because it was passed on the House side. We do have a fiscal and a revenue statements in your packet.
And we're in a public hearing, and then we'll quickly go, or a work session. We're in a work session. Okay.
No, you're in a public hearing.
Yeah, we...
You have to do a public hearing.
We're in a public hearing right now.
Okay. Good morning, Madam Chair, yes, and members of the committee. My name is Robert Plain. I live at 7931 Southwest Creek Hollow Court in Durham, Oregon. I'm a retired Marine, a combat veteran, as well as a disabled veteran. And I've been asked to represent the Governor's Task Force on Veteran Services today. House Bill 2762 will set aside May 8th as Military Family Appreciation Day. It will serve as a constant reminder that our military families are sacrificing on our behalf, that the service of the military member is only equaled by the sacrifice of the friends and family that support them during their service. It will serve as a moment of unity when military families from all eras can come together and celebrate the peace that only can come after conflict. And it will serve as a day for Oregon to publicly acknowledge that we are one community, and that it truly takes a community to support a service member, that we will do our part here while they do their part there. We have events commemorating the first Military Family Appreciation Day here at the state capitol, as well as in communities large and small throughout the state. On this day, we'll come together, learn from each other, and symbolically plant our state tree in neighborhoods where families, civilians, and military live and work. May 8, 2009 will be the beginning and not the end, because every year we'll come together and celebrate the values of duty, community, and family. Unlike Memorial Day or even Veterans Day, holidays where we rightfully reflect upon the past, this day will be a celebration of service in the present, a public statement that we are all in this together, whatever may come. Throughout our history, Oregon has been a home to people connected by both people and place. This place, our Oregon, is special because of our spirit. It's a spirit of service, of family service, servants. I grew up in a military family. I traveled to over 11 duty stations when I lived with my parents. My dad was gone over half the time while I was young. I saw the sacrifice and the worry that my mother and other military families endured. On behalf of all those who have served and those families, friends, and communities that supported them, you are doing something very special here today. Thank you for the opportunity to come here today and ask for your support for House Bill 2762.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited about this. As soon as we got word from General Caldwell and Paul Evans through an email that we were having this, I contacted the people who are very involved with veterans in my community, and we're going to have a celebration. We're going to plant a tree, and I'm going to be there, and my son's going to play taps, and it's going to be a nice event. So I think there are many, many communities that are doing this, so I'm excited about that. Any discussion? All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on 2762 and open a work session on 2762A.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2762A engrossed to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2762A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Marsette.
Aye.
Senator Moore.
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair
Montana. Aye. Motion carries, and I'd like Senator Boquist to carry this. And with that, we will close the session of House Bill 2762. And we would like to open a work session on Senate Bill 507. Courtney? Okay, we will close the work session on 507. We'll come to it a little later.
Yes.
Oh, Courtney. Sorry about that. I know you were at the end of the list, but there's some that I want to get through because we probably are going to carry over all of them, if not some of them. Oh, yeah, we'll reopen this work session on Senate Bill 507. Courtney, where are we on the amendments with 507?
Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. 507, we should have the -2 amendments. Those amendments have been, I believe, looked over. People got those yesterday. We are fine with them. There's one small error, but it can be fixed. It's just a numbering error, but it can be fixed at any time. I believe that the reason why I was outside, I was speaking to some of the insurance folks. They have one little piece they like to fix
in 507.
And again, we'd be fine with that too, the fix that they ask. So, and it's just making sure that the physician signs the contract when on the reactive the payments when they get paid. So they have to sign the contract before they get paid.
Excellent. Okay.
So we are fine and ready to go. Just probably one little fix and we could be ready on Tuesday.
Okay.
So we'll have a 3.
We probably will have a 3.
I'm not sure we can get amendments in.
If not, we can. We're more than fine of moving this on and fixing it on the other side.
Let's try.
Yeah. All right.
Madam Chair, I'm a little nervous about that. I'd like to have those amendments in the bill when it leaves this side. I want to make that very clear.
So let's get those.
I believe he already has suggested language. Blue Cross does, so we can just send that in.
All right, stay there, because we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 507, and we are carrying that over until Tuesday, and we'll open work session on Senate Bill 508. Courtney, where are we on
that one? Just this morning, fresh off the presses, we have amendments to 508.
And those are?
Those would be
The threes.
And they basically mirror the Washington state law regarding overpayment and recovery. And we should be all agreed upon, but not everybody has seen them. So we need a little time for everybody to look at them, and should be able to move.
Excellent. Okay, and it'll be important to make sure that we get them to fiscal, because we also have to have, if we move the bill, we'll need the -2s on 507, the -3s on 508.
Yeah.
Okay?
Madam
yes.
Chair, the -2s on 508 are a technical fix from a bill we did last session. They're mine. I don't think anybody has objections at this point, but please take a look at them. It has to do with being able to write insurance for those exempted under religious organizations, under the domestic partnership bills we passed last time. It was just kind of a glitch in law.
It would actually permit people to deny insurance to those with domestic partners. Is my understanding.
It was in the bill too. It was an exemption for religious organizations, but the way it was written, they can. And it's a matter of interpretation. There's a letter from Teresa Miller saying she thinks it's okay, but this just clarifies it's okay that folks can receive insurance under this exemption that is currently in the law.
And those are the -2s.
-2s.
All right. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 508, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 509. Courtney.
So you shouldn't have in your packets, again, they've just been given out, the amendments to -509 to -4s. So this is after two work groups and lots of conversation. Again, the insurance folks have not seen those. We just got them this morning, so we'll need a little time to kind of read through to make sure. But at OMA, we feel like we've done a lot of consensus, doing our best to, when we're getting suggestions from the insurance industry to put them in, a lot of the suggestion was look at the NCOIL model and put pieces in, and that's exactly what we did. So hopefully when they see them, the insurance companies will feel a little more comfortable with this, and we'll be able to pass this and move this on too.
Excellent. All right. With that, we will carry 509 over to next Tuesday, and we'll close, and you will send the -4s for the fiscal request, too. That will close the work session on Senate Bill 509. Thank you so much, Courtney. I know this has been a sort of turmoil, but we're moving along. All right. With that, I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 8. And that is...
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 8 allows volunteer health practitioner licensed in other states and registered with the Volunteer Health Practitioner Registration System to practice in Oregon during an emergency.
Colleagues, the way we had first... actually, I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 8 and call Dr. Higginson up. And he... we have now the, I believe, the Dash 3 amendments?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. And we have the fiscal?
Yes.
Okay.
No, we have no fiscal.
Oh, that's right. That's right. But we could suspend the rules.
We could.
Okay. Please introduce yourself and tell us about the Dash 3s.
Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I'm the administrator of the Office of Community Health and Health Planning, Department of Human Services, Public Health Division. And when I came and talked to you before about Senate Bill 8, we were very supportive of the idea, which primarily was to make sure that out-of-state health care providers would be available to provide health care services in the state of Oregon in the case of a disaster and a declared emergency. And we had some concerns with the original bill for a number of reasons, primarily because we already have a registry that we can simply build on. And so what the Dash 3 amendments do is they gut and stuff of the original bill and then simply adding to language to our current registry bill that we can admit to the registry health care providers from another state and that we can work with other states to facilitate populating that registry with providers not only in the state of Oregon but from other states as well. There is another section that we actually did not ask for that we're working with the Oregon Medical Board on right now to make sure that that does not usurp any of their authorities, and that's something that we believe that we can do by rule. And I'm not sure if you have a fiscal, but I did check this morning, and what the agency submitted was no fiscal impact with the Dash 3 amendments, and I've talked to Ken Murphy with the Office of Emergency Management, and again, we're talking about the Dash 3 amendments. They do not believe there will be a fiscal either.
And one question, though. Okay, after a year and all of a sudden we have a disaster in Oregon, then will it be up to you to make sure you have sent a message out? Because usually once a disaster happens, it's a little late to try and start getting these docs in the registry. Tell me how we are going to get these people on the registry.
Right, Madam Chair, right now we are in the process of marketing the registry to a number of health care providers in the state of Oregon. And once we get this bill passed, we would extend those marketing efforts to other states as well. And I think we would probably start out by talking with other states' departments of health and licensing boards to see the best way that we could get that kind of healthcare provider participation from other states to participate in Oregon as well. And I think what we'd primarily do is look to bordering states, and particularly those areas and states where we might pull healthcare providers in the case of an emergency.
You probably have to maybe do it physician by physician, but is it possible to work with the boards from the other states and then just have a blanket reciprocity with, like, say, those physicians and practitioners that are registered in the state of Washington? You could just contact them and they would let you know who's on their list, and then they could be, you know, practicing here, rather, because I think it would be very difficult to have each individual physician and practitioner sign up.
Madam Chair, we certainly will be working with licensing boards and professional associations in other states. You know, since this is a voluntary registry, we will have to deal with the individual practitioner to make sure that they indeed are willing to provide those kind of services, gotcha, or at least be contacted to provide those kind of services. But we certainly will be working with the organizations as well, because that's going to be an easier way to actually get our message out to those people.
Okay. Any other comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm still a little confused in this. Having gone through this with the Katrina episode on a personal basis, do we have a registry right now of physicians from outside the state that we could call on a voluntary basis to come in? Do we have that in place right now?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, no, we do not. We have a registry right now of in-state health care providers, and it's actually a fairly small number right now, but we're working to build that number. But we do not have the authority for out-of-state providers, and that's what this bill would provide for us. What we do have, however, is EMAC, the Emergency Medical Emergency Management Assistance Compact, which actually all states in the country have right now. So in the event of a disaster like they experienced in Katrina, Oregon, with a declared emergency, the governor can send out a message to other states saying we need health care providers or we need emergency responders in X, Y, and Z areas, and then states can provide those individuals to the state of Oregon to help with our response. And one of the problems there is that EMAC is primarily involving the public sector, and so we would not be able to draw on private health care providers, and that's one reason why we think that Senate Bill 8 is a very good idea.
Madam Chair, my knowledge of the Katrina situation was the only pool they could draw on quickly and easily was the public health pool across the United States, and public health doctors went in from various states to go in because they were licensed on sort of a national basis. Many physicians signed up through Red Cross. But in fact, Red Cross supplies housing and shelter, but is prohibited from doing anything medically. And so they got there and couldn't function. It seemed to me, I made an assumption from having gone to a couple of meetings 3 or 4 years ago on this, that we had a system set up of a group of our physicians who were signed up and can go, and we were contracting other states for the same thing. It sounds like that never really fully was implemented or happened.
Madam Chair and Senator Bates, what you may be thinking of is the DMAT, the Disaster Medical Assistance Team program, and that is actually operational. And Oregon has either one or two DMAT teams in Oregon, and we actually have the ability to use them as a state resource if they're in state, but also there are DMAT teams across the country that if there were a declared disaster, we could rely on those resources as well.
A follow-up.
So that is in place right
okay.
now.
A follow-up. I thought that was happening. That's why I was surprised the way you were describing things. The DMAP teams, are they registered and ready to come into the state of Oregon right now if they're from California or Washington or Louisiana or New York? Can they come directly in and quickly?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, they can come in relatively quickly, you know, and it's like 24 to 72 hours, but it is a request that goes through the emergency management channel, so a request that would go to the state emergency coordinating center to request that federal resource, the DMAT teams, to come in and help help out Oregon. But like I said, we do have in Oregon, I believe it's two DMAT teams right now, and we can rely on them as a state resource, and actually with the windstorms last winter when there was a need for services in Columbia County, we did activate that DMAT team and they did provide services in Oregon.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, Madam Chair, I was thinking that this might be mesh into the Interstate Compact in some way and try to expand those efforts. I do know one of the frustrations for a lot of our emergency responders that went to Louisiana was they had to sit there and do nothing until they could get trained to do the stuff they already knew how to do. And so clearly there are some glitches still in the system. I think this moves us ahead, but I would suggest that in the future we need to look at that compact and see how we can expand just beyond the public into allowing other entities immediate access into whatever state the disaster's in. So,
right. And Madam Chair, and Senator Cruz, if I could add, the existing language in our registry does allow for training of healthcare providers. So we will be moving in that direction.
And I would, since we really have not had an emergency management committee on this side this session, in the interim, I would like to follow up on this topic maybe in a broader sense, just so that we have a better understanding about what emergency management does and is. And I'm really, since it's the surgeons that are making a nationwide effort to get their names on a registry, because they are the ones, the examples that we had, they were the ones that had such a problem in Louisiana, that if we can address that then, because I think we really need to.
It was firefighters, it was everybody that had to sit and wait. True. So
no, and Madam Chair, we would very much enjoy working with you on that, and it's two sides. So, you know, on the one side, we want to make sure that there's no barriers to have people come in. On the other side, we as a state have a responsibility to make sure that those people are competent providers and emergency responders. And so to have systems like this, I think, is just critical, so that we're doing the planning up front and figuring out how we're going to ensure the credentialing up front rather than waiting to respond at the time of crisis.
Excellent. Yes, Senator.
And just to build on what you've said, it's not, I appreciate the surgeons are on the front line of this thing, but in Katrina we had physicians working to the point of exhaustion. Mm-hmm. Once they lost power in their hospitals, keeping people alive by handbagging them when they couldn't keep them on their machines anymore. And we couldn't get people in to help those people. Those of us who were trained in ICU like I am and others, if I'd gone down there at that time, I would not have been allowed in that hospital to help out. It's a bad situation. Mm-hmm. If we have a bad earthquake here in Portland, we'd be the same position. You can't get in. If you do get in, you're not allowed to practice, and that just doesn't make any sense. So this is what I think you're driving at here, we need to get it done.
Madam Chair, and hopefully we do. One of the stories that I found frustrating on Katrina was that they had yards full of buses that they could have evacuated people with, but they didn't have trained drivers to drive those buses. I mean, you know, how absurd is that? And that's where bureaucracy gets in the way of sometimes you just need bodies. So.
Okay. Thank you very much. We're in work session, and we don't have the fiscal, but...
Let's do the amendment first. And then
All right. We need the dash threes.
I'm sure I move the dash three amendment, Senate Bill 8.
We are in work session. Is that right, Cassandra? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Senator Cruz moves the dash threes into Senate Bill 8. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bates.
Aye.
Senator Morissette.
Aye.
Senator Moore.
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Miles Anderson.
Aye. Motion carries.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of sending Senate Bill 8 to the floor without a fiscal statement.
Senator Cruz moves that the rules be suspended so that we can move Senate Bill 8 out to the floor without a fiscal. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 8 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 8 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? Please note Senator Morse as excused. There's no opposition. So ordered. And President Courtney and I will carry the bill. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 8, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 23. And this, Mr.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 23 establishes the Oregon Patient Safety Commission as a central agency for collection of data and analysis by patient safety organizations in Oregon. We actually started hearing this bill a couple of months ago. There have been a series of work sessions and amendments. We are settled and I believe approved dash four. 1 and 4 at a prior meeting, and you do have the dash 4 fiscal statement in your packet.
Mr. Dameron, please let us be sure that we are supposed to adopt the dash 1s and the dash 4s.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Dameron. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. I believe there are two amendments in play, dash 1 and dash 4. Dash 1 simply changes a couple of words to make it clear about the who can collect revenues and what kind of revenues. So it's a simple, a technical word change. And dash 4 would take out two sections of the bill that are no longer relevant. So at this point, there's housekeeping.
And I'm so glad because we got the fiscal on the original bill, and it was pretty significant. All right.
Good work.
So we still need to send this to Ways and Means, but we are in work session.
Do we? There's no fiscal.
There is a fiscal in there.
Oh,
okay. Well, there
isn't.
But not for the, let's, we're going to just look for our fiscal. I thought that there was, but I'm not in there. On the dash fours.
I was under the understanding there was no fiscal.
Yeah, give it to me.
The fiscal statement really shows nothing. So.
It's zero. The fiscal is zero.
So I don't think
based on the dash four.
Right. So, Madam Chair, if we move the dash fours, I think we just send it to the floor.
Yep.
Because I don't think it has a subsequent referral by.
Well, the commission's main revenue source derives main revenue source is from fees.
Right. Senator Bates, do you want this or do you want it on the floor?
I don't want this to go to the floor.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
Zero fiscal.
Are we in work session?
Yes, we're in work
okay.
session.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 23.
Senator Cruz moves the dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 23. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. And please note Senator Morris as excused.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 4 amendment, Senate Bill 23.
Senator Cruz moves the dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 23. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. And please note Senator Morris as excused.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 23 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 23 to the floor with a due pass, as amended with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered, and please note Senator Morris as excused. And would you like to carry this bill?
Sure.
All right, Senator Cruz will carry the bill, and with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill
Thank
23.
You,
you bet. And now we will open a work session on Senate Bill 460.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 460 directs the Department of Human Services to establish a registry and advisory committee related to birth anomalies and adverse pregnancy outcomes. We heard this bill about a month ago. There was a dash 1, and now there is a dash 2. The dash 2 makes a significant reduction in the fiscal, even though we don't have a formal fiscal in front of us. It is my understanding that the amendments do reduce the fiscal impact.
I'm still sure that this will need to go to Ways and Means, but the way we changed the with the amendment was based on funds available, and I know Senator Bates, I think we talked about this a little earlier.
Right.
So we are in work session, and it's the dash twos.
Dash twos.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 460.
Senator Cruz moves the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 460. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered, and please note Senator Morris is excused.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of sending Senate Bill 460 to the Committee on Ways and Means without a fiscal statement.
Senator Cruz moves that the rules be suspended so that we can move Senate Bill 460 to Ways and Means without a fiscal. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. No. Senator Morris is excused.
Madam Chair.
Should yes. be coming any time.
Do you want with recommendation?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 460 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill be subsequently referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 460 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered, and it's going to Ways and Means.
Oh, that's right.
So we will close the work session on Senate Bill 460, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 520. Mr. Shook.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 520 directs the Department of Human Services to implement an Oregon State Hepatitis C strategic plan to promote public awareness of hepatitis C and directs the department to establish a pilot program for volunteer hepatitis C testing. This bill was heard about a month ago. There are no amendments that I'm aware of.
Again, this is something that Senator Cruz has been very involved with.
And Senator Morissette as well.
Oh, that's right. And definitely Senator Morissette involved with for a very long time. Hepatitis C is a very tragic virus to have. And we have this bill before us, and we are in work session.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 520 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
All right. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 520 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a prior reference to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? So ordered. I will close the work session on Senate Bill 520, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 454.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 454, carried over from 421, establishes the data reporting requirements for carriers offering health benefit plans for third-party administrators. At our last meeting of the 21st, this committee adopted the Dash 2 amendments. We have requested a fiscal, which you have in your packet, so we have the fiscal revenue and approval of the Dash 2. And, Madam Chair, this is the last of the seven Oregon Health Fund Board's bills that have been passed by this committee.
Yay! All right. So, with that, we've already adopted the Dash 2s, and we are in work session.
Madam Chair, before I make a motion, I just need to say that probably the most troubling part of this for me is the uniform standards provision of it. I find that incredibly troubling, and I know we are going to send this to Ways and Means. I would prefer to do it without recommendation, but it's up to what you want to do.
Senator Bates, do you, or Senator Morissette, or Senator Morris, do you have a comment at all before we decide what we want to do?
My understanding of that section is this is very similar to what Minnesota's done to streamline and control health care costs. Correct me if I'm wrong about that. Whose amendment is this?
We see the nods in the back row there.
Thank you.
Well, and just because Minnesota's done it doesn't mean it's right. But
well, I checked the people at Lake Wobegon, and they told me.
Good source.
That all their health plans, they're above average. Okay, and all the doctors are very handsome, and the women are smart. Anyway.
That was good.
Yeah. Yes. I can't remember how it goes. Madam Chair, we are stacking bills down in Ways and Means, not just to die, but to work them. And I know this is very contentious and difficult, but I believe from what I'm seeing here that this is probably ready to move.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it will leave Ways and Means, I cannot tell you. There will be discussions at that level, and the people in this panel will be a part of that discussion too. Even though you're not on Ways and Means. It's going to be very, very difficult and ties to other issues in this building, as you may well realize. So I believe this is probably ready to move as I read it today.
Okay, Madam Chair. at your instruction as your loyal vice chair. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 454 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you very much, Senator Cruz. He moves Senate Bill 454 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means with a prior reference. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition?
Yes. Call the roll.
Please call the roll.
Senator Bates?
Yes.
Senator Marquette?
Yes.
Senator Moore?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
No.
Chair Montanez?
Aye. Motion carries. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 454 and our last bill for the day. It doesn't look like we're going to have an evening meeting. I will open a actual work session, a public hearing on Senate Bill 856.
Madam Chair, carried over from 421 requires Department of Human Services to phase medical assistance recipients into cost containment system of provider contracts. Since our last meeting, we have been able to generate, as of this morning, I believe, -6 amendments, and I do believe there's a -7 in the works, but we do have -5 and -6 amendments, which have been distributed to members of the stakeholders.
And colleagues, we've really talked a lot about the fives and sixes already, and we don't have probably what's going to be the sevens, and I would like to have... Yeah.
Well, we talked about the threes and fours. The fives and sixes are amended versions of the threes and fours, so maybe we ought to have Tom Holt come up and explain the adjustments that were made.
Well, I was, all right, we can have Tom come up and explain the adjustments to five and six, and then I would like Carol Robinson and Janine Smith, who I ordered to come up with the sevens, to come forward to describe those, or Tina, or Ann Corey, the whole bunch of you. Okay, so Tom, explain to us what the fives and sixes are doing, and then...
Well, the difference between, because we've had the full discussion.
Yes, and I'm going to have Ellen... Ellie, please come forward also. Ellie Jenny, correct? Yes, because we overlooked her last time, and I apologize. All right.
Madam Chair, I might suggest we have Mike Becker come forward as well. He is involved in the update of these.
Okay.
For the record, Tom Holt, representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, on -5s and -6s. The -6s, again, represent the latest iteration of the collaborative effort of hospitals, number of insurers, and AOI, and a number of others who have been more informally involved in putting together this alternative. We've been, as you know, shopping this through the building amongst stakeholders for several weeks. The difference between the threes and fours and the fives and sixes at this point are largely technical. Again, what these do is I'll talk about the sixes. The six creates the health authority within DHS, charges it with various missions related to moving health care reform forward, creates technical committees within DHS overseen by an executive board to oversee that work and the 450 series of bills that you've now moved out of your committee. And then it also creates a new process for health insurance rate review that Mike will talk about in a minute, as well as a special purpose fund for Medicaid monies and matching monies that come to it. The difference between the sixes and the fives is that the fives, which Senator Cruz developed, do not create the authority but do create the same technical committees within DHS and basically give them the same jobs. And his amendment also, -5s, do not create the special purpose fund. And Senator Bates, we understand your concern about the fund, and we also understand very well that the fund could be pulled out in the form of an amendment in your committee, but we're not going to be the ones to do that. So,
thank you.
And so I'll leave it to Mike to explain the technical updates to the insurance rate review.
And please identify the amendments that you're working from.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Here to speak in regard to the insurance rate regulation amendments as reflected in 856-6 and 7. And the
6 and 7? Okay.
5.
5 and 6. Yes. We'll get
okay.
this right.
All
right. Sorry. And as Mr. Holt indicated, the provisions regarding enhanced insurance rate regulation are the same in the dash fives and the dash sixes. What specifically has changed in the fives and sixes as compared to the threes and fours that we previously presented on have to do with the discretion of the director to make decisions on rates. As originally written in the threes and fours, we had shalls instead of mays that took away all the director's discretion, which meant they weren't doing discretionary acts. They were just checking a list, and there was no discretion being exercised. To exercise discretion, we had to reflect that in these changes, and that's what you see in the dash fives and sixes. And if you would like me to walk you through the specific sections of the bill where we made those changes, I can do that.
It would be helpful, yes.
Okay, starting in section.
And let's work from the choose one. So that
okay,
on
I'm working off the dash sixes, but again, they are the identical in the dash sevens insofar as these
six.
Dash. I'm working off the dash sixes. They are identical to the dash fives in these particulars. If you look at
section 3, page 4.
Okay.
It's section 3?
Well, it starts in section 4. And actually, let me pull out my file here, and I will show you.
And while you're doing that, Corey, it'll be very important at some point for you to respond to what they are going to be saying today. And I'm not sure if you're able to do that today, that's fine. If not, we'll do it Tuesday because we won't be moving the bill today. We need to really digest all of these amendments and talk.
Madam Chair, thank you for indulging me here while I
no problem.
Find this. Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Could I direct him to Section 3, page 4 of the Dash 6 amendments? That might be of some help.
It starts out with the Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services. That they'll analyze individual and small group yeah. health insurance market. Right.
Chair Monis Anderson and Senator Bates, those are not the provisions that were changed between the threes and fours and the fives and sixes. It has to do in insurance rate regulation
okay.
under Section 6.
Okay.
Where the department is. Okay, yes. This is Section 6. Section 6, Section 7, sub 5.
Give them the page number.
On page 7.
Of the dash 6.
Of the dash 6s.
Thank
you,
Corey.
Yay, Corey!
And
Corey, come here and say this for me. Probably be easier. But it specifically says that
page 7.
On page 7, that sub 5, the director, after conducting an actuarial review of the rate filing, may approve a proposed premium rate for a health benefit plan for small employers or for an individual health benefit plan if, in the director's discretion, the proposed rates are, and then it goes through the rating standard. That's where the wording was changed from shall, and this phrase, in the director's discretion, was added. So that is the key change. Sorry,
from the dash.
Threes and fours.
Threes and fours. Yeah.
I apologize for it taking me so long
to find
that.
That's okay. That's okay.
And Chair Miles Anderson, for the record again, Tom Holt. Senator Bates raised Section 3. That is where we would have DCBS do an in-depth study of the potential for an exchange and basically come back here with the pros and cons on various elements that we've laid out to be studied, to be examined, and then come back here with, you know, either a thumbs up or a thumbs down, and if it's a thumbs up, to have a plan of how it would operate to bring to your approval.
Great. Okay.
Madam Chair, I think that section also speaks to the probability or possibility of a public plan that was available also. Is that correct?
I believe it does.
Chair Monis-Anderson, Senator Bates, yes, it does include as part of that analysis and reporting to the 2011 legislature work in regard to whether a public plan would be needed.
All right. Is that it?
All right. That is it. At this
Excellent.
Point, we're rather
and
fond
thanks
of
for all your work.
Either one of these or something resembling them.
I mean, we're going through some major health reform in this state, and it's so important to make sure that we hear and get input from all the stakeholders, and I really appreciate the work that you've done. All right?
Thank you.
All right. So, Ellie, Jenny, please come. I know we're in work session, but we missed having you testify last time, and I want you to be able to give your input.
Okay. Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Ellie Jenny, and I'm trying to make sense of all that, you know, is happening in the healthcare reform, and not that I don't appreciate the effort, but my big concern as a consumer of healthcare in Oregon, and a member of the Oregon Health Plan, I receive benefits from that, but what I'm concerned about the words cost containment, and then when you put rapidly as possible together with that, it my concern is for the consumer, the person who is supposed to be receiving the benefits, that they that their rights are upheld and that they won't suffer. And I don't read that anywhere, that, and that's my big concern, is that folks who are receiving services, especially if they've got chronic special needs, won't have those needs met because of cost containment. I mean, I've fought cost containment for a long time in different areas, and it's a pain. And I just think that people who are already in non-healthy situations and have significant need don't have to wonder, you know, if the product they get is going to be exactly what they need just because it may cost a little more.
And I'm glad you brought that point up, Ms. Jenny, because with these, I'd say, cost containment bills, we're looking at electronic records. That's not going to affect your services.
Okay.
We're looking at technology. That's cost containment, but not going to affect your service. We're looking at an end-of-life registry.
Yeah.
That's not going. That will be able to save money. And so those bills that we pass, we're saying it's going to save millions of dollars so we can actually provide more services. That's at least my intent. So I wanted to waylay your fears on that.
Well, I appreciate hearing that, because it's not printed out, you know, like that, and I just needed to make sure that it got said.
I'm glad you did. Thanks so much. Now, we do have a dash sevens, but I think there'll be the dash sevens, but we don't have them yet. So what we're going to do is have Carol Robinson and team come up. to discuss proposed amendments for 856 that I requested. I definitely wanted to see some change, primarily with the fiscal. And so we will now spend the rest of the time going over those. Come forward.
Cowards.
Cowards. They have done so much work on this. Everyone has. So.
Chair.
I have to go to a buyer situation.
This is what I wanted you to hear.
And this is what I want to hear.
Okay. Can you?
How many stages for
over? Dr. Bates has to leave, so hit the highlights in 5 or 10 minutes with then more.
Chair Monis Anderson, committee members, for the record, my name is Carol Robinson, interim executive director of the Oregon Health Fund Board, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today. In response to your request, Senator Monis Anderson, we set about developing an amendment for Senate Bill 856 that would best reflect the recommendations of the Oregon Health Fund Board. The product of that request, which we will refer to today as Dash X, but we assume we'll probably be dash sevens, will look very much like House Bill 2009 that was passed out of committee yesterday, and that was certainly intentional on our part. We believe House Bill 2009 to be a very strong representation of the Health Fund Board's recommendations, but the amendment is not identical. It's very similar. First, I'd like to be very direct about the alternative amendment proposals that you will be considering for Senate Bill 856. The Health Fund Board and analysis of the Dash 5 and Dash 6 amendments proposed by Mr. Holt, the Coalition of Hospitals and Insurance Companies, and Senator Cruz do not adequately create a health authority with the operational sanctions to effectively serve as an integrator of state health services as envisioned by the Oregon Health Fund Board. So Tina and Dr. Smith will outline the differences between the Dash X amendment and House Bill 2009 and the two alternative proposals for Senate Bill 856 in more depth. But I'm sorry we don't have the actual amendment available for you today. There were unavoidable circumstances in LC that caused a delay in the drafting, and I expect that we shall have our official version out today or early tomorrow. I'll admit, I was intrigued at an earlier committee meeting when the Dash 4, now Dash 6 amendment, which is described as a real implementation plan. We took the amendment back to the office and studied intently, looking for a connection between legislative authorization and committee structure that basically suggested studying and the technical and advisory committee structure that was set up in the Dash 6. You'll hear more about this in the matrix comparison in a minute, but first let me just underline this point. Using the word implement does not make it so. And so this is our big concern with the Dash 6 amendment now. In Dash X amendment, we have incorporated the 7 bills that you have now passed out of the Committee to Ways and Means into this comprehensive reform proposal. I like to call those some of the function pieces of health reform, the real action items that will begin to bring cost savings to fruition and help to start making health care more affordable. The idea of cost containment and affordability is really what we need to emphasize here. We are not trying to contain costs for critical benefits, but we are trying to make healthcare more affordable by streamlining, by being smart purchasers, by integration of services in a better way. And there are smart proposals that you have considered already and passed out of this committee. But in order to get those done, we need to provide a form, and that is in the creation of a strong health authority with the operational authority to begin integrating the state's health entities and implementing the functions of the first strong steps of health reform. As with the other amendments before you, the fiscal estimates for this amendment have not been calculated in total, but you are aware of the $4 million total fiscal for the seven bills that you have currently passed out. There would be additional minor costs for beginning the authority, but one critical difference between House Bill 2009 and our Amendment X is that we recommend keeping it within DHS for the 09-11 biennium. So the cost would simply be for developing appropriate planning to streamline agencies and programs as the authority gets ready to become independent in 2011. However, it would be short-sighted to be penny-wise and pound-foolish when considering policy changes as significant as the health reform proposals before you this session. This is really the key difference between the other proposals and either House Bill 2009 or the 856X amendment, because by actually implementing the initiatives lined out by the Oregon Health Fund Board to organize and streamline state purchasing, to simplify administrative functions for claims processing and billing, by creating and managing a pulse registry, by implementing measures for patient-centered primary care homes, and so on, you can't expect to get anything more than more plans for actions instead of the real actions that begin to save money. Before I pass the presentation over to Tina and Dr. Smith, I want to remind you of the conservative cost-saving estimates that will be realized as a result of implementation of real reform under the watchful direction of a health authority. And so I point you to the estimated cost savings that I passed out included in the proposed amendment for 856. And we have based these estimates on experience of other states with similar initiatives adjusted for population and demographic differences. And we have not included in these cost estimates the additional market-driven savings that may also be realized from transparency of costs as a result of the All-Payer, All-Claims data reporting program, or from a broader adoption of evidence-based guidelines in commercial purchasing, which we estimate to be substantial but are not included in these cost savings estimates. So just to underline the short-term savings potential in Amendment X. In Senate Bill 455, which is rolled into Amendment X, there's up to a $650 million savings in 3 years from the Clinical Improvement Assessment Project. With the patient-centered primary care homes and healthy communities actions, there's up to a $45 million savings in 3 years. And with the just today passed Improved Transparency in Healthcare Reporting Initiative, which was Senate Bill 454, there would be up to $110 million savings in 10 years. I want to contrast that to saying you may think that sounds like a whole heck of a lot of money, and it is. I mean, we're talking over $1 billion potential savings from those three actions in the first 3 years. But when you contrast that to the fact that healthcare is a $20 to $25 billion enterprise in Oregon, you realize that that potential for savings is actually there. So I urge you to, as you consider this very, very important reform initiative, be it Senate Bill 856, be it House Bill 2009, whatever vehicle that you choose as legislators, that you understand the very key importance of not only impacting reform this session with expansion of coverage, but also with making healthcare more affordable through these actions. And I'd like to just ask that Tina and Janine walk you through our matrix of comparing the proposed legislation.
Thanks so much. Chair Mona Sanderson, for the record, Janine Smith, the Administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research. What you have before us is a fairly rapidly done analysis since we were busy
yesterday with others
on 2009. And by the way, 2009 did pass out yesterday.
But what we tried to do is take the Health Fund Board recommendations, which are on your far left, and then compare them with what is in 2009, although that probably needs a little bit of tweaking still considering what went through yesterday. We tried to capture as much as possible. And then the proposed, per Mona Sanderson's request, to try to create something here on the Senate side, which is the famous X. And then we compared to the dash fives and the dash sixes, since these were refinements of 3 and 4. And then in your far right are some comments trying to outline the differences. So I'll start and try to be fairly quick through this. You also should have received a copy of the proposed language as it was submitted to LC, and so that you have a version. And then the other cost containment piece that Carol mentioned. So if you look at the health authority, I think this is where is probably the marked differences between the industry's and Senator Cruz's recommendations and what's in 2009 and what is going to be appearing in X. But essentially, there's sort of a disconnect. The essence of the Health Fund Board was to try to have something that was an integrator and sort of started streamlining and trying to get a lot of disparate activities to be more aligned. And 2009 does that through a health authority that initially starts outside of the department but has shared services and essentially cross-coordinates. The X will have it technically in DHS that first 2 years and then moving out. When you get to 5, there's an executive board created, which is really a renaming of the Health Policy Commission, which we've had for several years, but there's no actual health authority created. In dash 6, there's a health authority created, but there's sort of a disconnect between you have 14 some committees that's under the Department of Director of DHS, then you have this executive board of the health authority over here, and then you have DCBS doing something over there. So there isn't an alignment, as far as from my read of these amendments, in how that all works together, with the essence of the Health Fund Board recommendation meaning continuing to move forward in alignment. So there is nothing that says in the dash fives or sixes that these 14 subject areas, that there's a requirement to report back to the Health Authority Executive Board or be responsive to the Health Authority. There's no connection with the work going on in DCBS. There's a health exchange work group under the director, but then there's this health exchange business report over here. And to be perfectly honest, I think Tina and I have post-traumatic stress from 329. Barney Spate, when he came on and the three of us sat down, we got one whiteboard up and we put the 7 committees and the report that was due and the 2 work groups. I'm going to have to ask for a second whiteboard to be able to I mean, some of these committees are captured in your Senate bills, which is another issue. Is this a separate committee versus the committees that are, there's a few set in your Senate bills. We tried to set up the health information technology one to fit to be one entity that when we apply for federal stimulus dollars for health information technology, there's clarity that there's a uniform direction. But now you have this HIT committee over here, and you have maybe an oversight council over here. How do we explain that to the feds that we're organized and working forward together? So there's just a lot of issues. Even if you consider this as a duplication over here, there's still additional 5 or 6 committees you're asking us to staff. So it is, again, when you all go home, we have to actually do this. So I'm trying to think about how best to do this and make good policy. I think the better policy is in having some organization around a health authority entity that, and however you structure it, and we can make it as low cost as necessary to build on existing resources, but it's the alignment that's sort of missing in the dash fives and the dash sixes.
Any more, Sam?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you ought to invest in an IT expert that can do a PowerPoint with visually showing the squares and so on and the divisions, which would be much, much easier to understand.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Morissette, that would be lovely, but I think I don't have it in my budget. So there's a lot of issues anyway around the health authority. We tried to outline these here based, again, on the currently available information. Then if you go on under bringing everyone under the tent, as you know, the lots of this was pulled out of 2009 and put into 2116. However, remaining, if you look across and 5-6, there's this fund. When you look at the language around the fund, there is some concerns that the current OHP standard enrollees would not be covered through this funding source. So that's 25,000 folks. So I think there's some issues there that need to be sorted out. And then moving on down, expanding coverage to all Oregonians, there's direction with an authority to continue to move forward. In 5 and 6, there's a direction to look at a health exchange, but it doesn't clear, it isn't quite the same direction. Moving on to setting high standards.
Just a minute. We're going pretty fast. Okay. I just want to go back. Expanding coverage for all Oregonians on page 2. So, because this is, since we have not had 2009 before us, I just go over expanding coverage for all Oregonians and what that really means.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, the 2009 has asks the authority board to submit a report, basically a phase two. You received the full overall recommendations from the health fund board. The current legislation in play at the moment is a kind of first best steps. And so what the language is in 2009 and is mirrored in X is to take, okay, give us more detail about what we're going to do for the next step to cover more beyond just the expansion of Medicaid. The small business folks, what can we do about a business plan? How does an exchange fit into that? How would we pay for it? So in 2009, there's directive to flush out what the work of the health fund board started for step two, and then this is to kind of really get down to the business plan aspects.
Okay. And then the set high standards, measure and report.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tina Edlin. I'm the Deputy Administrator with the Office of Health Policy and Research. And I'll just, Janine and I agreed to tag team this, so not one of us would be talking the whole time. So I'll take a shot at this section. Set high standards, measure, and report. The first item recommended, and this is really seen as a key item in the Health Fund Board report, was to establish an all claims, all payer database. And it's the piece that you passed out of this committee in Senate Bill 453. It has the comprehensive language from 453 in both House Bill 2009 and in Senate Bill 856X, that the words that you have in front of you. 856, the dash 5s and the dash 6s basically establish advisory committees to advise the DHS director about health care data reporting. Empower the authority to set standards. In 2009, the in consultation with the DCBS, the authority is directed to set standards and rules for DCBS to review. The 856X basically has the same kind of language in it. And then I think you just heard what the differences are in the dash 5s and the dash 6s from Mike Becker.
So moving to page 4, creating.
Yeah, I'm just still digesting the all claims data collection program and the standards for purchase of health care services.
Chair Mona Sanderson, another concern I have that I didn't talk about, it's just a detail in the 856-6s, is that they've reached, actually the proposed language reaches into our statutes, statutes of OHPR and health planning, and actually removes some definitions, some financial definitions that we use for a lot of our reporting. So I don't know why that happened, but our point of view is that those definitions should be left in statute.
That state again who uses those financial definitions?
No.
When you say we,
Office
you mean
of Office of Health Policy, and I think they're also used for the Certificate of Need program.
Okay.
Ready to move?
I'm ready.
Page 4. The 2009 incorporated Senate Bill 455, and that is also incorporated into X. The dash 5s and 6s set up a committee, advisory committee, to look at these. There isn't as much of a directive to state purchasers to develop strategies to adopt the guidelines, which is actually where you all changed the language to shall instead of may, so it's not as directive. And then again, getting back, there's no operational charge for the authority or additional authority for DHS to make to enforce this adoption or to oversee this, and or to and not to get into regulatory issues, but it was really more that you don't have that overriding authority. You know, are these, how do these align with strategies around quality standards? And again, you lack the alignment across, because you just have this committee set up in 5 and 6. Moving on to establish an Oregon Quality Institute. This is created under the authority in 2009. It's
I'm sorry, I'm still trying to digest, just because I have not followed 2009. And so, again, when we're talking about clinical improvement assessment, we're developing guidelines. When you say guidelines, for what?
They adopted the language that you passed in Senate Bill 455. So
455. Okay. All right. Now I'm with you.
And so moving on to the Quality Institute, again, it's aligned under the authority in 2009, will be also in X, and it's to be used, and there is a typo here that it's all state or public purchasers of health care, and then trying to promote it across into private payers. So there's a couple words not there. Dash 5 and dash 6 talk about a committee to talk about the improvement of healthcare quality. But neither the legislative language doesn't empower an authority or DHS to establish incentives for achieving the quality goals or benchmark. There's no operational charge for the authority or additional authority within DHS, making it impossible to really understand if anything is truly implemented. It's just that you have another committee that's going to talk about it.
And just remind me again, the Quality Institute does what?
Chair Mona Sanderson, the Quality Institute was a discussion in the Health Fund Board to try to align the ongoing current quality efforts going on in the state, and trying to make sure that we're all doing the same thing kind of on the same page. It doesn't have to be a bricks and mortar entity. It was more of a virtual entity. We realized that a full one is fairly spendy, but we wanted to start down setting some common quality standards that PEB, OEB, Medicaid, everyone would start to use the same quality expectations in their contracting and purchasing of state for coverage for state purchases.
So it's mainly for the purchasing piece. That's what.
And with the intention that then if everything's a little more aligned, you're more likely to be it easier for the provider network to be able to do it, rather than if just PEB does it or just Medicaid does it. Any one practice. We have a multitude of insurers coming in the door, and the goal would be to try to align all of us so that as a doc, I don't have to think which quality standards do I need to make sure I'm doing for this patient who's at this insurance and versus that insurance.
This is only for PEB, OEB, Medicaid?
With the intention of trying to partner with it's intended for the public purchasing to try to align
public.
Them as much as possible. But be in alignment with what the community is doing as well in the private sector. So similar common quality standards that if we could get to them. The Quality Corporation has started this for outpatient. We have it for hospital inpatient already started. But how can we make sure that it's that when PEB purchases care, they're going to make sure that network follows those same set. And when Medicaid does it,
but it follows the same set.
And Chair Mona Sanderson, I think I'd add to that that the vision of the board was always that we would work very closely with the Quality Corp and follow national guidelines developed by the National Quality Forum, so that there would be a core set of quality measures that are established and we can all work toward.
Would we have pushback from providers?
Chair Mona Sanderson, I think the feedback that we got from providers on the Quality Institute work group was that this would actually simplify their daily existence, that if they had one set of quality metrics that they're looking at rather than multiple sets from different health plans.
Does this affect insurers in a remote sense of way?
Chair Mona Sanderson, I think, again, it affects insurers in that they would be looking at, every insurance company that I've ever had experience with in any way they have quality standards in place, and they've developed them through usually a pretty thorough and thoughtful process, but they can be different depending on the company. And I think, again, if getting everyone around the table and agreeing on a core common set, which is what they've already done for outpatient and quality core work, I think it simplifies things.
I was just thinking of the contracts that are set up between, say, that's different. So they wouldn't necessarily come under the guidelines that we would set up for our public.
Chair Mona Sanderson, yes, that's right. I think that the long-term vision is it would be most advantageous to everybody if we all could get around the table and agree to this, but this just directs the public purchasers.
And carrying along that theme, we looked at one of the Health Fund Board's recommendations was how to best unify purchasing power primarily.
We're on page 5 now.
Primarily, correct. Primarily around public purchasers. So there is, in 2009, a public health benefit purchasers subcommittee to identify and recommend to the board specific areas where perhaps benefit design and contracts, if we had this common set of metrics, can we see if we can have more directive to make ensure that these are followed through on? And this includes in 2009 cities and counties to at least all sit down together and look at this and see how to best align. The dash X would also, the 5 and 6s talk about an advisory committee to recommend the standards. Again, the concern, I think, is that they're not necessarily integrated along. If the health authority sets up a board through a quality institute, sets up some standards, will the committee that's set up in 5 and 6 be obligated to use the same set, or are we going to have duplicate activities? So it's just, I think, you know, it may be just the way it's laid out in 5 and 6, but that was the concern, that there isn't an overarching policy alignment. I believe the next is establishing a health insurance exchange, and I know that...
I'm still trying to grasp this concept. Public employers health cooperative.
So in 2009, it was we talked about it in the Health Fund Board, was how could we get everyone around the table. One of the things that is in 2009 is that PEB and OEB is administered through one administrator. They actually have that person and the whole them come in under the health authority in 2009, and then this is setting up a cooperative to sit down with cities and counties and other public purchasers who aren't under direct control of the state to talk amongst themselves and try to figure out how to align things. In 5 and 6, PEB and OEB do not move in under the health authority. They're still over in DAS, the Department of Administrative Services.
Who is under still?
PEB and OEB live in DAS.
And cities and counties.
And then the cities and counties aren't moved in either any of these scenarios. It sets up, so there's a functional aspect where PEB and OEB start to come in under the authority in 2009. In 5 and 6, in all of them, there's a committee to sit down and talk with cities and counties about how to align things further. So the differences are really just, especially on a PEB OEB basis.
Mm-hmm. Manager,
yeah.
How does that change if PEB becomes self-insured?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, it doesn't change if we're self-insured in the sense that the PEB board can then, it actually allows the PEB board to have more flexibility in benefit redesign because it's we're not having to take any particular benefit package from a fully insured partner. We can talk with our ASO to develop a package that that they might want to fit in.
Yeah,
Madam Chair,
that's fine for PEB, and it would allow them to do that. But I'm not sure how you align a self-insured with the other entities you're talking about that aren't.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Cruz, I think the idea is that could we have if PEB is asking for this in their contracts with their providers, be it through self-insured, and OEB might be asking for it even being fully insured, and Medicaid is asking for it, we're going to get kind of hopefully everybody to be working around the same goals, which is getting the right care at the right time and in the right place. And who carries the risk is really the only difference between self-insured and a fully insured. The self-insured, the PEB takes the risk in a fully insured Regents or whoever your or Providence or whoever your carrier is takes the risk. So I'm not sure that risk who take bears the risk is it, the idea is that you would for the last several years the PEB vision has been that we wanted everyone to have a medical home and we wanted everyone to have a essential benefit package based on evidence, and we've worked with our fully insured partners to do that. We also have some self-insured partners. We've been doing this with a small subset of Providence for several years. We were doing it with Samaritan for a while as well. So there are, you know, PEB's been dealing with both self-insured and fully insured entities for the last several years.
Senator Morissette?
I've been assuring the cities and counties and special districts and public employee groups that all of this would take place within the contract negotiations and there would be a coming together at some point.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Morissette, I think this is really what in 2009, what they're trying to get to is that everyone would kind of sit around the table and say, okay, this is what we're doing, this is what we're doing. This is the common metrics that might be set up. That how are we all aligned, and so where could we kind of be in better alignment, and why should we? And there would be explanations of why those are the better ways to align, you know, why to expect these kind of quality standards versus those kind of maybe no quality standards or not enough quality standards. So it isn't that we're necessarily there's been a lot of work in the 2009 in the House committee about how to align, how to alleviate any fears that the state's going to come in and take over the cities and counties. That's not the essence. Mitch has worked quite a bit with a work group to try to get the language here to be comfortable with the cities and counties, and that was what the Health Fund Board wanted, was not to direct and be, you know, we're going to come in, we're the government. It's more how can the government entities sit around the table and talk about these, and it's not mandatory.
Good.
So now, my topic that you really need to explain.
And I don't know if we want to have Ms. Streisinger to come up and join us, because she is really could probably talk about the health exchange a little and the rate regulation, if you would like, for a few minutes.
Yes, because I truly need to understand what a health exchange really does, because I know that the one I think in Massachusetts is not working well. And we're trying to set up something that maybe isn't working well somewhere else. So I really need to understand how Oregon can adopt this concept.
Chair Mona Sanders, I would just want to add that in 2009, initially, the very first bill you saw come out early in January, they set up an exchange. The bill that passed out yesterday sets up a direction to come back with a business plan for an exchange. That's very different. So we're not committing ourselves to a health insurance exchange in 2009. We're doing a business plan. And I'll turn to that.
Madam Chair, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And with respect to a health insurance exchange, a health insurance exchange can do many things. There isn't a health insurance exchange isn't one set thing. And how a health insurance exchange is structured pretty much depends on what you want to use it to achieve. And so, as Dr. Smith said, what I think is common to all of these proposals in front of you is the need to develop a business plan that identifies what the goals are and then what the mechanisms are to achieve those goals. For example, a health insurance exchange can be a very efficient way of equalizing risk. A health insurance exchange can offer standardized plans so that consumers can easily do comparison shopping. If there is an individual mandate, that is a requirement to purchase insurance, a health insurance exchange can be a way of facilitating that. A health insurance exchange could allow people who have multiple part-time jobs, for example, to buy insurance with contributions from multiple employers. In its simplest form, you could view a health insurance exchange as simply a shopping mall where different insurance products are available in a standardized comparative way. So the business plan that's, again, I think fairly similar in House Bill 2009, the Dash X amendments, and the Dash 5 and Dash 6 amendments, really needs to look at what the impact of all those decisions would be. There are some choices that you could implement through an exchange depending on what you do with other choices. There's, for example, quite a bit of interest in on the part of some advocates in changing the rating structure to have and the market to have guaranteed issue, where a health insurance company can't choose who to insure. They have to offer insurance to everybody without regards to their health or claims history. Currently, we have guaranteed issue in the small group market, so a small group between 2 and 50 employees is entitled to purchase insurance from any carrier offering small group insurance. But we don't have guaranteed issue in the individual market. We allow insurance companies to choose who to insure based on health claims, and then we have the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, the high-risk pool, that provides coverage for people who don't qualify in the private market. If you move to a requirement that everybody have insurance, you could also move to a requirement of guaranteed issue, that is, where everyone has to be offered insurance, and an exchange would be a convenient way to facilitate that, and again, to spread risk and have common standards for application, common administrative procedures. But all those are things which haven't been developed yet. The exchange committee of the health fund board made a set of recommendations that were based on how an exchange could and should be structured, in their view, if there is an individual mandate and a premium subsidy mechanism. Without an individual mandate and premium subsidy mechanism, there's probably other choices you'd want to make.
So I'm still trying to get my hands around what an exchange is, and that is then basically various plans. Are there various plans, or one plan, or various plans for, like you said, someone who has many jobs? And I still need to get a hold of how the consumer takes advantage of an exchange.
Madam Chair, an exchange is an offering of many plans offered by private insurance companies. So in one possible way, the sort of simplest version of an exchange would be a tool where all insurance companies that want to participate in the exchange offer standardized plans. If you think about the, for example, Medicare supplement plans, those are all standardized. You can buy an A plan, a B plan, a C plan, a D plan, and all carriers that offer a D plan, it's the same. So you can compare one D plan to another D plan. So you could use an exchange in that regard. You could say anyone who wants to participate in an exchange has to offer an A plan, a B plan, and a C plan, and those are the same. So that I can, if I'm selecting a C plan from carrier number one, carrier number two, carrier number three, it's going to offer the same benefit structure, and I can compare based on other things. I can compare based on price. I can compare based on network availability. I can compare based on whether my doctor is part of that network. But I can know that my deductible and my benefit structure is going to be the same. So that's one thing that an exchange can do. Another thing that an exchange can do is funnel money. So that, and again, that would be the example of if you want to have multiple employers be able to contribute toward an employee's coverage because they have multiple part-time jobs, the exchange could function as the bank, if you will, where the money comes in from those various employers, is accumulated, and then the employee can use those various contributions to purchase one health care plan. So those are some of the types of things that an exchange can do, but there's no one thing that an exchange is, and that's why I think the general feeling is that a business plan needs to be developed. It needs to actually have the detail work that would allow you to press a go button deciding on what that plan is. So how are carriers selected? What are the benefit plans that are going to be offered? How's it going to be funded? Is it going to be the place where money flows in and out or not? Is there going to be a uniform enrollment system where people can fill out one application form and then that will qualify them for any number of plans? All those are sort of the nitty-gritty logistics, and they're going to be determined by a number of policy decisions that have to be made. So I think the structure that's contemplated really in somewhat similar fashion by all of these proposals in front of you is to say, let's, during the next interim, develop that nitty-gritty work and come forward with a here's how it would work and possibly several options for here's how it would work based on what those sort of big picture decisions are.
Well, do we have any history in other states where it is working or is not working? I know Massachusetts is the only one that I've heard about, but can we learn from why it hasn't worked in other places?
Madam Chair, Massachusetts is an interesting study, and there's mixed reports, and one of the policy decisions that was made in Massachusetts is cost containment later. And I think the general conclusion is that means costs go up. And so costs have gone up for that exchange. On the other hand, the exchange was part of a larger package that included at least a partial mandate to purchase insurance and some subsidy mechanisms. And really the exchange itself, I think what most people would say is an exchange is a tool to do different things. And Massachusetts chose to do various things using the exchange as a tool. But the exchange itself isn't the determinant of success or failure. And I think Dr. Smith and Ms. Edlund may be able to speak to that in a little more detail.
Chair Moses Anderson, members of the committee, the exchange is still operational. It's in transition. They slowly moved things in or slowly moving things in. So they only have about a year or so of experience. Yes, there are some cost issues, but as Ms. Streisinger said, they weren't focused on cost containment the way the Health Fund Board really felt it was a two-track process, expanding access to coverage and make it affordable. And so I think they're now looking at ways to make things more affordable, again, being allowed to use the exchange. So an exchange onto itself is maybe not the ideal policy directive. It's really more, it's a tool to get enhanced access to care and figure out how to make it affordable for everyone. And at the same time, all other cost containment type activities or affordability activities need to go on hand in hand. There have been some smaller exchanges in, I think it's New Mexico and a couple other states, and now on a national level, there was just an article came out yesterday from the Urban Institute funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation that I can pass on to all of you that just kind of summarizes how it is a marketplace organizer and some of the thoughts on it. Should we do one on a federal level? How would states interplay with that? So it is continuing to be under debate and redesign.
Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we required insurers to all offer a basic essential benefit plan that we've talked about, and that became the floor, would we need an exchange? And the exchange seems to me to be just a super broker that would potentially create another layer to absorb cost, as opposed to just requiring some things to happen and then let the market work.
And, Madam Chair, Senator Morse, if the goal is simply to have standardized plan offerings, you're correct. An exchange wouldn't be essential to accomplish that. We could say all carriers participating in the market need to offer Plan A, Plan B, and Plan C. And, in fact, that language is part of House Bill 2009 and some of these other proposals as well. But there are, as we mentioned, some other things that an exchange can do that probably can't be done without it, and one of them is funneling funds. And then there may also be some administrative efficiencies that can be obtained through an exchange that it actually ties into one of the concepts you talked about earlier and that was incorporated into Senate Bill 454, the issue of administrative standardization. For example, the application process, if that's a single standardized, centralized point, the exchange could serve that function. So, again, it depends what you want to do. There are market reforms you could certainly institute without an exchange, and I think the version in the dash 5s and 6s is set up to have an examination of whether an exchange would aid in moving the market. I believe the language in the dash X's and House Bill 2009 says develop a business plan for an exchange rather than decide whether to have an exchange. But the House Bill 2009 and the dash X's recognize that that decision will need to come back to the legislature, and that, in fact, if, again, determining what the policy recommendations are, if an exchange isn't needed to accomplish them, my assumption is those recommendations would come back.
Thank you.
Very helpful. And then the only other point I would make is that in the dash 5s and 6s, DCBS goes off and does the business plan, but there isn't any, and comes back to the legislature. It's not necessarily any alignment with the health authority or the health authority executive board or the director of DHS. It's kind of, they're sort of in isolated boxes. Versus in 2009, it's the health authority board develops the plan in collaboration with DCBS, and comes back to the legislature. So, again, it's not quite as aligned or collaboratively described.
And, Madam Chair, I'd agree with that. One of the goals, I think, of having it some type of integrated with the health authority type of structure is to, in fact, have these different pieces of the discussion work in conjunction with each other. So who is assigned to be the lead in particular tasks, I think, isn't nearly as critical as ensuring that there is collaboration and coordination, and we would certainly advocate for a health authority role in connection with the exchange, although, of course, we feel DCBS can play an important role as well.
Thank you. Further questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering what the role is for insurance brokers in this concept. It seems like they just go away.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, that's actually one of the elements that's called out in these bills as something that needs to be examined as part of the development of the business plan.
Senator Morris, in Massachusetts, the brokers still play a role. Brokers actually could use the website to go in and help advise their clients. There's other roles for brokers to help, especially in our state with very small business. They do a lot of other activities besides just find them an insurance plan. So there's an interplay role. And from our discussions, and we have someone in our office who spent a lot of time looking at the exchange
change and talking to people in Massachusetts, their connector, the brokers were still included and parted. It's not that we're trying to usurp the brokers or put them out of work or anything like that. It really is more how can we make sure that there is an entwining of the what the expertise and the relationships they have with those community members who come to them for advice and direction.
Madam Chair, I guess it just begs the question then, how do we escape the fact that we're creating another layer of cost if we're not eliminating a function? And so that would, the devil would be in that detail.
Plan.
Thank you.
So that would that business plan then come back and then the legislature would vote A or nay on whether we want to go that route or not?
Madam Chair, yes. I believe that's the intent of all of these proposals.
Okay. Any other questions on the exchange? Okay. And we have about 5 minutes. We could go to 10, but...
Did you want to talk about the rate?
Madam Chair, it's up to you in terms of the schedule. I'm also prepared to talk about the rate review issues
yes,
that are in the
absolutely.
Net 5s and 6s. So the rate regulation proposals that are in the dash 5s and 6s actually are not...
And we're talking about what page?
I'm sorry. In the dash 5s, it's sections 4 through 7. In the
but I meant on the matrix, are you addressing that?
On the page 6.
Page 6?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't this... Okay. Implement regulatory actions to contain health care. That's the rate reviews.
That's how the matrix refers to
yes.
it.
Yeah.
And in the in it is not actually in House Bill 2009, but there is very active discussion on these proposals on the House side in a different vehicle, House Bill 3145. And I did bring, and I don't want to complicate the paper, but if you want them, I did bring the dash 5 amendments to that bill, which were adopted by the House Consumer Protection Committee last night.
It wouldn't hurt for us to have them, and then we can put them actually... keep a copy here if we need to have it for discussion on next Tuesday.
Okay.
And then, because we will be getting the engrossed House Bill 3145. Well, that's in Ways and Means. I forget we're not going to get that.
Actually, 3145 is in House Consumer Protection still. They adopted the amendments, but they haven't passed the bill out.
Right.
But it would go to Ways and Means, wouldn't it?
I don't believe it would go to Ways and Means.
Okay,
it just,
so we would
it is
get
a
it.
Change to the rate regulation standards only.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say we really appreciate the sponsors bringing the dash 5s and dash 6 amendments forward to this committee. There, I think it's broad agreement that rate regulation standards need additional clarity and transparency, and both the dash 5 amendments to House Bill 3145 and these amendments, I think, go a long way toward doing that, and there is considerable overlap in them, as Mr. Becker said earlier this week, although there are also some significant differences. The what these sections do, and again, it's sections 4 through 7 in the dash 5s, sections 5 through 8 in the dash 6s, and they are the same in both sets of amendments. So I'm going to talk from the dash 6s just because it's the one I happen to have in front of me.
And that's sections what?
Section starts with section 4, so on the bottom of page 5. And generally what these amendments do is they set out factors that should be considered in evaluating a rate filing in the individual or small group markets. And they provide a public comment period, and they provide standards for what needs to be submitted. And they also, building on House Bill 3103 from last session, deal with making rate filings public and have the department setting standards for what's confidential and what's public, so that there's greater clarity for the public about what's in a rate filing. Some of the differences in House Bill 3145, the Dash 5 amendments, in addition to a public comment period, there's also an ability to have a hearing before approval of a rate in certain circumstances. That hearing is not included in these amendments. In addition, there are some differences in the factors to be considered, and there is quite a bit more detail in what needs to be submitted and what can be considered in the House version of the bill. There is a threshold with respect to reviewing administrative costs in the House version of the bill. That is, if increases in administrative costs exceed CPI, there's a higher standard. That difference isn't made in this bill. But again, there are probably more similarities than differences, we appreciate these versions being brought forward. There are some key issues that I did want to flag in this set of amendments. And the one in particular that I wanted to bring to your attention is one of the factors set out in reviewing rates. In the Dash 6s, you'll find it on page 8, and it's section 7, subsection 6H. And so if you look at page 8, lines 14 through 17, this is in the Dash 5s and 6s, in reviewing a rate, the department would be required to take into account the types of things you would expect about trend, about medical losses, about administrative expenses. But then this section says that in order to approve a rate would need to include a contribution to surplus that may not be less than zero. In other words, a contribution to surplus, but never a contribution from surplus. Surplus it's actually a bad word because it makes it sound like it's extra money. It's not extra money. It's the insurance company's capital in excess of reserves. And an insurance company is required to maintain surplus, and they're required to maintain surplus at certain levels that and we oversee for those levels, and it's very important to insurance company solvency. Nevertheless, if an insurance company sets rates based on predictions, and predictions are an inexact science, and so it may well be that an insurance company ends up collecting more in rates than it anticipated collecting, and its surplus may grow faster than it anticipated, and its surplus may grow to a considerable extent. And so the policy question in this regard is, do you ever want to see a rate that requires a contribution from surplus? That is a recognition that in prior years rates were high, maybe higher than they needed to be. Surplus grew, maybe surplus grew faster than it needed to grow. And do you ever want to have the department have the ability to say to an insurance carrier, your rate needs to actually have that surplus come down a little in reflection of that? So that's one situation that this language would prohibit. The other issue that this language would...
Of the Dash 6s.
Dash 6s and Dash 5s and 6s both. Mm-hmm. Same language is in both. Mm-hmm. The other concern we have with this particular provision is that for a new entrant into the market, a new insurance company or an insurance company that is entering a new market segment or rolling out a new product, it may well be that that product is not profitable or that company is not profitable initially. It often takes several years of entry into the market to reach profitability, and so there may in fact need to be a contribution from surplus initially in order to allow new entrants and new products into the market, and we'd be concerned that this would actually be prohibited with this language. So we would prefer for this factor to see an allowance to take into account a contribution to surplus or a contribution from surplus. In addition, we believe that there are some other factors in the House side language that are important and useful, and I'd be happy to walk through detail if you want, but I think basically the concept in the House side version and in these versions brings the conversation to the right place, which is what should the standards be, and what type of public involvement should we have in rate review.
Interesting. Thank you. Questions? A lot to get our arms around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm happy to come back.
We only have one more meeting.
Oh, you may see a version coming from the House side, or they may see a version coming from
the
House.
That's right. Chair Moniz Anderson, I don't know if you want me to continue through, but we continued to outline in the rest of the matrix some of the issues around how to stimulate system innovation, healthcare system design. Many of these factors are similar to the Senate bills that you addressed, and as you can see, many of them are, they actually have all been adopted into 2009, and so therefore also will be appearing in X. And in some ways, I could almost say most of these, but I can go through them more individually if you would like. 5 and 6 have a little less detail and just talk about a committee to look at these without, as I mentioned before, overhanging opportunities to align across an authority. So
what I'd like to just jump to then, if you don't mind, since
sure.
We're getting down the last 5 minutes, go to page 7, unless someone else wants to talk. What's this Payment Reform Council?
Chair Moniz Anderson, the Health Fund Board suggested that there should be a Payment Reform Council, realizing that the Delivery Committee did a lot of work, but we didn't get into the nitty-gritty of what exactly how we should pay differently. We started down that road but didn't quite get there. So the essence in 2009, I think, is to get to the same end, and we'll need to go back and check the amendments in the exact language as it comes out. For 2009, it's in X. We put the recommendation to utilize the payment system and payment reform as a tool to correct incentives in the healthcare system. -5 sets up an advisory committee. -6 asks the authority to actually implement healthcare provider reform, and that this committee is. But then on the other, then there's the director of DHS setting up an advisory committee. So in many ways. It just seems somewhat challenging on how, if you don't have this alignment across these entities, that you would institute coordinated payment reform without direct operational or policy authority. In 453 that you passed, you directed UPR, just because we weren't sure what the entity will be eventually, to do this. So it's basically in Senate Bill 453. It's sort of an outcome of 456 when we're setting standards for integrated health homes that we would want to pay from, and so it kind of that's a natural progression to payment reform around primary care. So I think that in this particular instance, it's a little unclear how five and six, how things actually happen, versus a little more directive in dash X. And I think the intent is there in 2009. I just have to double check the language.
Very helpful. I don't have questions on the others because I can read, but I want to jump then to page. And please, committee, if you want to address something, but let's go to Medical Liability Reform Council.
Again, Chair Moniz Anderson, this is
on page 8.
Page 8 on the second row. The thought from the Health Fund Board, again, because they did have a lot of work out ahead of them, they didn't get into the details around medical liability reform and suggest that a council should be set up to take it the next step. There isn't explicit language in 2009 about this. There was some discussion of possibly another vehicle in the House side for this. We put it in X, and you also put it in Senate Bill 453, where you directed OHPR to set up that and have some consulting dollars to do that. So that's what's in X. The -5s and -6s also set up an advisory committee on medical malpractice. But again, the question is operational charge for the authority or DHS to implement the committee recommendations.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I can't let it pass. my biggest disappointment in this whole discussion.
I agree. Yes,
Madam Chair, but there will be a group working with Senator Pozanski to take a look at this, so I encourage you to be working with him.
It won't happen.
Not much comfort in that.
Okay, and I understand.
I think I pointed out the HIT, the concern here,
right,
is that 452 is a little more explicit to try to mesh with federal stimulus dollars requests, and it's a little less specific in dash 5 and 6.
Okay.
And there's no health. I think the other thing to point out on page top of page 9 is while we tried to sort of take the health equity subcommittee's recommendations throughout all of our bills, there isn't any parallel language in dash 5 and dash 6. And then 457, there's a committee set up in 2009 for the workforce, and also then going forward with what you passed in 457 to collect better data. The 5 and 6 just talk about a committee being set up, not necessarily better data collection.
One problem I, too, have back on page 7, integrating behavioral health services with physical health services. But I think we did have a bill that we did not, we're not going to work session, but there is some really big efforts that the department has taken regarding mental health, and I think sort of a wait and see along those lines.
Well, Madam Chair, yeah. I think Senator Bates and Representative Kotek have had work groups on that subject.
Yes,
so
that's what I'm referring to. Departments actually spearheading.
And Chair Moses Anderson in 456 with the primary care, patient-centered care integration across of many specialties, including behavioral health, was an emphasis there as well.
Well, you know, I really appreciate everyone. We have been struggling with the health care reform and what's coming down the pike from the House. And this has been, for me anyway, a huge help in understanding the issues that the Health Fund Board, what we've come up with through the Health Fund Board report, and then also getting reactions from the extremely important stakeholders that sort of make everything work in this system. So I thank you very much, and we will not be having a meeting tonight because we were able to cover everything, and even though we didn't go through everything in the matrix, we have it in front of us, and I do plan to move this bill in one form or other, but I need to get input from the individual members of the committee.
When will we see the X amendments?
LC is here. Can you come to the microphone?
Chair Monica Sanderson, Senator Morris, I've been in touch with LC this morning, and they're working on them as we speak. So hopefully before day's end.
Okay, thank you.
That's extremely important. All right, with that,
before you adjourn, I would like an opportunity to cast a ballot.
Suspend.
Is that possible?
We haven't on all these others.
Excuse me.
If I have an excused absence, then I'll let it go. If it's unexcused.
You were excused.
I was excused?
Yes.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, you were definitely excused.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair,
Unless
you want to suspend the rules to vote, or?
That's fine. No,
because we could.
That's fine.
All right.
I don't have many absences. I just wanted to make sure it was excused.
You just need a quorum to suspend the rules, I think.
Okay.
It's unanimous vote.
Well, first of all, we're done with. I'd like to close the work session on Senate Bill 856 and.
Suspend the rules,
Madam Chair. I move we suspend the rules to allow Senator Morse to vote on Robert. Which bills?
Senate Bill 8, Senate Bill 23.
Well, let's list all of them.
Suspend it in block. So were those the two?
No, 23, 460.
And I voted on the other.
Yes.
Okay, just for those
okay.
three then.
For what he said.
8, 23, and 4, 60.
60.
Senator Cruz has moved to suspend the rules to allow Senator Morse to vote on Senate Bill 8, 23, 460, and House Bill 2762A.
Right.
Is there any discussion? Any opposition?
Well, no, go ahead.
So ordered.
Madam Chair, just to summarize, we'll carry over to...
No, wait, we're not done yet.
Let's do this and then we'll summarize that.
And then?
So just ask him how he votes.
Oh, yes. How do you vote? On Senate Bill 8?
Aye.
Senate Bill 23?
Aye.
Senate Bill 460?
Aye.
House Bill
2762?
Aye. And thank you very much.
You bet. All right.
All right, Madam Chair. Just to summarize, for Tuesday, the 28th of April, we'll carry over 856, 911,
mm-hmm.
796, 507, 508, 509. And currently on the agenda is Senate Bill 18, Senate Bill 750, Senate Bill 914, and the work session on Senate Bill 804.
So I think it's doable, everyone,
yep.
And we may go late if we can't get all of them, but we'll just go late, and unless they have a call of the House, we'll be.
Well, call the House wouldn't bother us at all.
I mean, call of the Senate. All right, with that, we're adjourned.